Welcome to the Weekly on WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. I'm Owen Anderson, and with me is Jamie Yu. We are the co-news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you all are doing well. For today's show, I'm talking to Jamie about her interview with Oberlin alum Tiffany Fung. How are you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing really well, and I'm really happy that I get to talk about this article, because just speaking with Tiffany was such an illuminating experience, and I'm really happy to be able to talk about it.
Great. Can you give us a quick introduction of Tiffany?
Yeah, sure. So Tiffany Fung is an Oberlin alumnus. She was from the class of 2012, and she was an art history major. And after graduating from Oberlin, she took on a master's program in scientific illustration at the Zuid University of Applied Sciences in the Netherlands. And since then, she has co-founded Biotic Art Lab, which is a medical and scientific illustration studio with her two classmates. And now she's based in the Netherlands and creating scientific illustrations for various companies.
Awesome. Thank you. So this article that you wrote was for the Oberlin news page on the Oberlin website. How was the process for this interview different from the work you've done with the Oberlin Review?
I'd say overall it was pretty similar. It was still a news article, so it still involved reaching out to a source, writing questions, interviewing them, and then writing an article based around their answers. But also, I was working with the Office of Communications, so I had different supervisors. And I'd say some of their policies are different. Like, I think it's just the major differences between the Oberlin Review is like just general company policies versus the Office of Communications. Like, for example, the Oberlin Review requires you to have at least three sources in your article. So a lot of my articles in the past for the paper, a lot of the work just involved like thinking about like, okay, I have my main source, but who are two other people that I can talk to? And then with this article, it was just Tiffany. So we set up an interview, we talked, and then I wrote the article out. Another thing was that the Office of Communications is actually a bit less stringent about direct quotations. So I noticed that when they were editing my article, they did change around some of the order of my paragraphs, and also they did a little bit more paraphrasing than direct quotations. So it gave me a bit more freedom in how to kind of introduce topics in a new way, and also how to sort of clarify some of Tiffany's comments. Not that she needed really a lot of clarification, because she's a very articulate speaker, but just like when she was talking about some of the more nitty-gritty aspects of illustration, I was able to kind of modify some explanations a bit.
Mm-hmm. So Jamie, what did you know about scientific illustration before the interview? How did you prepare?
I really didn't know anything about it. I didn't even know it was a thing. I didn't know that it was a field within illustration. And I found it so fascinating because as someone who does art for a hobby, my understanding of the field is fairly limited already. But I feel like up until then, I'd really thought of art as a purely creative field that didn't have any overlap with science or math or engineering. And after I got the pitch from my editor, so my editor, Amanda Nagy from the Office of Communications, she forwarded me a video in email that featured Tiffany. And it was basically kind of I wouldn't say it was a press release, but it was a video that was sort of talking about her master's program in the Netherlands. And it was her and several other classmates, and they were kind of giving an American or international perspective on the program. And so that was kind of where I got like sort of my first overview of what she did. And then from there, I looked up her personal website. I read a bit about her bio. I looked up Biotic Art Lab's website and kind of their about page. And then I also looked at her LinkedIn to see like her job history and then find out that she was an art history major. So from there, I kind of worked my questions around that. So I asked her, you know, could you describe your work? What materials do you use? How long does it take to finish an illustration? what was your master's program like, especially because the US has basically no graduate program specifically for scientific illustration, and how she found out about it. And then I kind of asked him a bit more about like her history after graduation and how she even found out about the field, because it does, I mean, for me at least, it seemed like a pretty obscure field. And just like listening to her talk about this sort of subset of art was so interesting, because it was just such an interesting blend of science and art that I never really had thought about, because I don't think a lot of people realize that there is an artist behind the pamphlets at the doctor's offices, or the textbooks in your school, or even the road signs that you pass by. They're all like an intentional idea from a designer or an artist.
Yeah. So just like for the review, the website doesn't have an infinite amount of space. Can you talk more about like these parts of the conversation that didn't make it into the article, but you were still interested by, or they still resonated with you?
Oh, there was so much. Just because I think my own personal perspective, I love art and I always want to learn more about it. And getting to learn about scientific illustration in particular was so eye-opening for me. So Tiffany, everything Tiffany said was so interesting and enlightening. But also, like, she opened up about, like, it took a while to get there, to the point where she was running a studio with her friends and doing freelance projects for pharmaceutical companies and schools. And she talked about how it actually took her 5 years to get into her master's program, because she initially started out by working in some galleries and kind of just doing a bit of museum work. And then from there, she met an alumnus, and that person told her about the program. So from there, it took a long time for her to really seize that opportunity. Because I asked her, like, I guess once you found out about it, it seemed perfect for you, right? Didn't you want to jump on it? She said, yes, but it took a long time. And it was because she initially thought about doing a program in the US, but as she mentioned, there are very few programs for scientific illustration in the US. And there was also a matter of like finances as well. So she described how she had to work full time on top of taking classes at UC Berkeley. And then finally she figured out that it would be a lot easier to find a program in Europe. And something she said was, it was a stressful time and it made me wish that I'd known about it earlier. But with a field like this, there's no way for you to know earlier. You're just happy to find out about it at all. And I think that really speaks to the true obscurity of this field and how, you know, when you find that niche, it can be so relieving and eye-opening, but it takes a while to really find it.
Yeah. And it is such a niche field, but I don't know, just the more that I thought about it, just kind of like an unsung hero of education in general, just because, like, at least for me personally, I have a pretty difficult time just like visualizing things when I'm learning about them in like science classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so those illustrations are always really helpful.
Yeah. And that was something I asked her about too. I asked, like, you know, does it bother you that this kind of work is so overlooked by the public? And she said it didn't really matter to her because the point was, and she was saying that that's actually a sign of good design. And she said, if it's done well, you almost don't notice it because it's just meant to convey knowledge or information. And if it's done poorly, remember it. And she said, if it flies under the radar, then it's doing a good job. And I thought that was really eye-opening because, again, with art, you think of it as creative and how artists want so badly to be noticed and recognized for their work and be hailed as kind of a visionary and creative. But really, with like, I think unsung hero is a very good term for it because they really are. They're just doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work. You know, when you're in the doctor's office and you see a pamphlet on like lymph nodes and stuff, it's just like, oh, okay, well, I know where they are and I know what they are now. But you don't really think about like the artist who had to study human anatomy and biology to illustrate that accurately.
I don't know. It just seems like it would be like such a steep learning curve if you don't have, like, you have to not only have to have the artistic skills and technique to illustrate it, but you also have to have the knowledge and understanding of what you're illustrating for it to be accurate. And like, it seems like you'd have to have almost as much knowledge as like anyone who wants to teach the subject.
Yeah. And what's interesting when I was speaking with Tiffany is that she came into Oberlin on the pre-med track. And she was kind of deterred from that path because she didn't really like the work-life or the lack of work-life balance and the lifestyle of it. But she was still very fascinated in science and anatomy and biology. So she explained that, like, yes, you need to have artistic ability to be a scientific illustrator, but you also need to have an interest in what you're illustrating. So it's not just, like, human anatomy. It's also, like, plants. It's also animal anatomy. It's everything really more around, like, the natural world than creative arts. And I believe that's what the program teaches as well. She explained how, like, her master's program in the Netherlands in particular really stressed hand-drawn illustration because it really trains your body to learn how to visualize something accurately within proportion and draw the human body in a more accurate way. Because with digital programs, it's really easy to just correct yourself after you draw it. So her program really emphasized traditional artwork. And then from there, she worked with Photoshop and stuff to create the final drawing. So everything was, it was so interesting because it really is a kind of an equal blend of art and science.
Exactly. I'd like to pivot a bit here. So Tiffany's an alum from the class of 2012. Have you interviewed alumni before?
Yes, I have. I started this position at the Office of Communications in the spring of 2020. So it is a student job. I do write for them. And my main task last year was basically to run the After Oberlin column. And that is a Q&A column that ran in the, well, it still is running in the student news section. But basically it's a Q&A format where we interview recent graduates who graduated within the last 3 years. And we talk to them about what they're doing now and how their Oberlin education prepared them, like personally, professionally, and academically for their current endeavors, whether that's grad school or working or internships or taking a gap year. So it involved a lot of networking and speaking with alumni. But I guess, you know, I'd say it still counts because they are alumni, even though they're very young alumni. But actually what helped me out a lot in the beginning was I reached out to my old pal, Ife Ezimora, and she graduated in 2019 and she was my pal basically in my first year. So I reached out to her and I said, could you help me reach out to some people in your class year who graduated that I could talk to? And she sent me a huge list of students, and like very, very diverse as well, like diverse majors. They were student athletes, STEM, humanities, social science, everything really. So I just reached out to them. And honestly, it was, even though I had to basically do one column a week, it was no problem at all because everyone was so responsive and so friendly. And they were like totally cool with me just cold messaging them on Facebook, or even LinkedIn or email. And really, like, it's just been such a positive experience because I feel like Oberlin alumni and OBs in general are always so eager to talk to people, and they always just really genuinely want to help you. So I've really never had a bad experience talking to an alumnus. And I think because of that, it's really helped me grow my skills to just like get over my anxieties of like cold emailing and just asking questions about people, because OBs in particular, like, they really love to talk to people. And and even with Tiffany, for example, as soon as she emailed, she was like, she said like, oh, thank you so much for reaching out to me. I love talking with current OBs and learning what everyone's up to. And during our interview, we did deviate off script a little bit, and she asked me about how Oberlin was and what the students were doing now, and like whether study abroad was still feasible because she studied abroad in Paris, and that was what led her to her decision to do her master's program in the Netherlands. So she was, I loved talking to her because I learned so much from her, but also she was just so warm and friendly. So, and I really think that Tiffany is representative of pretty much all of the alumni that I've spoken to.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've spoken to a lot of alumni. Can you talk more about the dynamic between past OBs and current OBs, maybe comparing it and contrasting it to, like, the dynamic between students and professors?
Mm-hmm. I would say I think it initially does start off as a professional relationship because it is a form of networking. I think it really varies by the age that you're speaking to, because some of the younger alumni, they're only at most like 3-4 years older than me. So we usually just have conversations that are fairly casual, and I would ask them about like their field and what made them want to pursue this particular post-grad plan. It's usually not me who has to initiate it. Usually when they email me back, they're already like very casual and friendly, so I feel less pressure in having to kind of maintain a professional appearance. But with other alumni, like for example, during the SOAR program last fall, there were a lot of alumni speakers, and I usually try to kind of send them a quick note on LinkedIn or by email and just say like, hey, thank you for the presentation today. I learned a lot. But of course I couldn't really write it like that. I had to be much more professional. So I would say it really depends on the age. I think once you hit a certain age where these alumni are very clearly like working professionals and adults, then it's kind of more similar to professors where you need to keep a professional rapport with them. But everyone is still very friendly. Like especially with informational interviews on Zoom, you know, it's important to like dress nicely and be professional and polite, but it still manages to stay a bit casual. And I think that's the nice part about it, is that it's not super nerve-wracking.
How did you start working with the Office of Communications?
Yeah, it was very spontaneous. I think back in November of 2019, I just saw basically a notice in the Campus Digest that said, the Office of Communications is hiring, please email if you're interested. And at the time, I was a production editor for the Oberlin Review. And because I was working 6 hours a week on copy editing articles, I didn't really have a lot of time to write. So I thought like, oh, well, you know, I think the Oberlin Review's schedule is super tight where you, if you are writing, then you only have like 2 or 3 days to really turn around an article. And I thought like, this would be interesting because I could write, but for like a different department and kind of get a new perspective. So I emailed them and they reached out, and it was it wasn't even like a job interview. They were kind of just looking for students to take up open spots. But it took a while to get started because by the time they replied, it was like almost finals in the fall semester. So I said, like, I think it would probably be better if we could meet up after finals. But then winter break happened, and then I spent winter term at home doing my project. So I didn't touch base with them again until the start of the spring semester. And then they basically just approached me and said, if you're willing to take it, we'll give it to you. And then you can help out with the After Oberlin column and then maybe do some on-the-ground reporting for some campus events. So I took it, and it was a really great experience. I only got to do it in person for 6 weeks. All of the After Oberlin reporting was remote anyway, because I had to email and message people who were not at Oberlin anymore. But I did get the chance to cover some campus events. I remember I went to an event for Oberlin Drama at Grafton, which was the prison drama program. And that was really fascinating. I had never heard of that program before. So I got to go to that reception and talk with the people there and the former actors, and talk with the professor who was organizing it. So that was a really interesting article. And then after we went remote, they still continued to assign me things. So I spoke with some outgoing seniors who were embarking on PhD programs in science. And that was a good way to reconnect with some seniors as well.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And then over the fall, I didn't do as much, but since the spring semester started, I've been doing a bit of reporting. So before, with the After Oberlin column, I would have to reach out to people myself. But this spring, I suppose my supervisors aren't having me stay as on top of that as I was before, and it's more like I'm just taking articles that they pitched to me. So they pitched me Tiffany, Tiffany Fung, so I reached out to her. They also pitched me a topic where I interviewed two computer science seniors about their experience at LaunchU, so I interviewed them, and that was an article. And then they also pitched me some recent alumni, like four after Oberlin, that I did a Q&A session on, but I haven't really been doing a lot of after Oberlin articles recently. But it's overall been a really great experience. I think it's been a great way to connect with people on campus, off campus, alumni, professors, faculty, all sorts of programs, very much like the Oberlin Review.
Great. Before we end our conversation and then turn to your recorded interview, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would, actually. I feel like since I've taken this position at the Office of Communications and started speaking more with alumni, I feel like I've really developed my skills for networking and cold emailing and talking to new people. But also, I reached out to a lot of alumni for just kind of their perspective on postgraduate plans. But honestly, from them, I've gotten a lot of career advice, but also a lot of life advice. And it's been very reassuring as the pandemic went on. And I feel like that can start to, well, it does create a lot of uncertainty over, like, what's the future going to look like? What is life going to be like after graduation? What's the job market going to look like? And a lot of what I'm hearing from, especially these young alumni, are really telling me to just kind of take it slow and remember to breathe, and that things are never as big of a deal as you think they are. And I think some of the best advice I've gotten was that you, like, even though it seems like you need to have, like, everything figured out by the time you graduate, you really don't, and you really have so much of your life ahead of you after college. And that's really what it's all for, to kind of learn about it and figure it out. So I would say definitely also don't be afraid to reach out to people, because it really is a lot easier than some students might think. And it really just takes, like, a quick message or an email. And during these conversations or informational interviews, like, definitely don't be afraid to be real with them. I have talked to some alumni where I've admitted, like, you know, I wanted to ask you about your career path, but also it was because I'm wondering about pursuing this career path and I don't know if I should. And they've gotten really real and they've said, you know, even though I'm in this career path, it doesn't work for everybody. So, like, remember to think about it critically and really ask yourself, like, if this is something that you really want. And I feel like people are so wise, and I feel like I've learned so much from just all these conversations that I've had over the last year. So it's benefited me a lot.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for talking about your article with Tiffany Fung on science illustration. And thank you for sharing your experiences with interviewing other alumni as well. It's nice to just kind of sit and talk. And thank you for being our guest for this week of the show.
Thank you so much. It was so great to speak about this with you. And yeah, I really appreciate our one-on-one conversations as well.
This has been The Weekly. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. We would now like to air Jamie's interview with Tiffany Fung, class of 2012. A print version of Jamie's article was published in Oberlin's news page on February 23rd, 2021.
So to start off, I watched the video that the office sent me from your school, the Maastricht Institute of Arts, and I remember someone in the video mentioned that the U.S. has only about, like, three graduate programs specifically for scientific illustration. So I wanted to ask you, how were you introduced to the field of scientific illustration, and what got you interested in it?
So what you'll find if you do a little bit of Googling is scientific illustration and medical illustration are sort of intertwined. Scientific illustration encompasses a bit more, like botanical illustrations and things related to animals. And then medical illustration is pretty specific to human medicine. So I didn't learn about it until after I graduated from Oberlin, and I was working at a gallery space in California, and I was a little bit confused about how to use my art history degree. And I was lucky enough to meet someone who went to CCA, which is the California College of the Arts, and they told me that this field existed, and that it was just the perfect meld of the two things that I had been sort of trying to go after my whole life, but not knowing which one to commit to. So I actually learned about it after I graduated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you learned it was a potential career path. So what made you interested specifically in the I hope I'm pronouncing it right, the Zuid University of Applied Sciences?
It's pronounced Zuid. It's Dutch, so it's really hard. So as the video said, there's actually four programs in North America, one's in Canada, and they're all really fantastic programs. I just knew that it's a bit different the way people approach their master's education in the US. You graduate, you take some time to figure out what you want to do, and then you make that decision. And I knew that I wanted to live abroad again. I had had some experience from my time at Oberlin when you have, what is it called? When people go study abroad, it's been so long. What's that year called?
I'm a third year currently, but honestly, study abroad is like really off the table right now.
I studied abroad in Paris when I was a junior, and then I knew after working 4 or 5 years after my graduation from Oberlin that I wanted to go back there, and I knew that applying for a job and getting sponsored is much, much more challenging than becoming a student. That's why you see people becoming students all over the world. I met a man who was in his 40s when I was in Thailand, and I was like, how did you get your visa to stay here? And he just enrolled to study Thai, and then he can just live there.
So like a student visa, basically?
Yeah, so student visa really, really helps. And the Netherlands and the US have a really good relationship, so you can basically stay here for as long as you need until you get naturalization. So that's really helpful for people or students who are considering doing a master's after their undergraduate. It's significantly more affordable here in Europe, all over Europe, not just the Netherlands.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So I guess more for your job as a medical and scientific illustrator, how would you describe your work in a nutshell, and do you specialize in anything?
So medical illustration involves the study of both life sciences and visual communication. We basically are illustrators / designers that operate within the healthcare, medical, and pharmaceutical fields to provide visual content and educational material for those industries. So it can look like a lot of different things, from textbooks to helping create 3D models of new medical devices to creating illustrations for doctors who are doing research and want that research published. So really, it's a really versatile field, and people who stay in it long enough end up having a specialty. But I actually just opened my own company right after I graduated last year with two classmates. So we're pretty new. We're only 6 months-ish old. So we're trying to figure out what our specialty can be, just because it takes time to reach out there and see where the need is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Biotic Art Lab, I was actually going to ask you about that later. That's yeah. So cool. Okay, so with the illustration itself, I was actually curious, like, what materials or programs do you use, and how long would it take you on average to finish an illustration?
So the program that I went to has a strong focus on traditional media. So they taught us to do everything by hand and then digitize it and then finish it in the computer, just so you have a strong understanding of form from the get-go. It's kind of hard to cheat when you have a pencil and paper, and when you start pieces directly in the computer, there's just the urge to just find a Google image and work off of that. So we're trained in traditional media, but nowadays we work totally digitally. So it's the whole Adobe Creative Suite, Photoshop, Illustrator. Getting a good tablet is really important. next wish list item is iPad, because Procreate is huge amongst artists nowadays, tattoo artists, illustrators, and medical illustrators as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I remember seeing like the giant tablets in the video and being so jealous, because I draw as a hobby, but it's nothing super serious, and I have like pretty cheap materials, but it gets the job done.
No, I mean that's where it all starts, you know. Most of the medical illustrators in the field are one women, which is super interesting in both the US and in Europe. And I work with a lot of introverted people. I think it attracts introverts because we like to just, or they like to recede into their little cave and just draw for days on end.
Yeah, art is pretty solitary.
Yeah, I always admired the people that studied studio art at Oberlin. I originally went to Oberlin to study pre-med, and that lasted about a year and a half. And the reason why I was able to switch over to art history was because of winter term. So winter term gave me the opportunity to do random things each year and try out different fields. And I actually decided to go and shadow an ER physician in New York for the month. And after doing 12-hour days for multiple days on end, I realized that while I was interested in medicine, the practical life side of it was not something that I could see myself ever really accepting. It's a lot of administrative work and standing on your feet and not a lot of interaction with the patients. And I just really liked the knowledge that they learned. So then I switched over to art history. So that's kind of how I started moving back over to the fine art side.
And for that specifically, how did your art history degree influence your postgraduate plans and in your current career?
It gave me a critical eye for anything visual. When I graduated, I spent a few years working at museums and galleries, but then I realized that I wanted to do something more creative in the sense of myself creating something from start to finish. And that's when I moved into design. I've seen a few people from my same year also go that route. And I think having that art history background just gives you the general appreciation and love for all sorts of visual arts. And then you can just branch off from there.
And I remember in the video you mentioned that your graduate program specifically was ideal for people who were kind of caught between science and art and didn't really know what direction to go in. So you started out as a pre-med background, you switched to art history. Did you envision having science be a part of your career while you were at Oberlin? Because you didn't learn about medical and scientific illustration until after college. So did you initially see art history as like completely separate from science, or did you want to find a way to incorporate it into your career?
Honestly, when I switched over to art history, I thought that I was done with science. And I remember looking at the course book and seeing some like a junior or a senior level, some higher level science courses, and being really sad that I would never take them. So I thought that you had to choose one or the other, because in my mind at the time, they existed on opposite ends of the spectrum. So no, I did not know that I could combine the two. I thought that I would have to commit either fully to art or science.
So what was it like when you found out about the field of medical and scientific illustration? Did you feel like you just had to jump for it?
Yeah, I found out when I was 23, but it still took me 5 years to pull it all together, because at first I thought I wanted to stay in the US, and the North American programs have quite strict prerequisites. So I started retaking all of my science courses. And that took me several years because I was working at the same time.
Where were you taking the science courses?
I was taking it at UC Berkeley Extensions.
On top of work, wow.
Yeah, it was a stressful time, and it made me, it made me wish that I'd known about it earlier. But with a field like this, there's no way for you to know earlier. You're just happy that you find out about it at all.
And then that led you to finding out about Zaid and then eventually like relocating to the Netherlands.
Yeah. Definitely.
Well, so I'd like to pivot over to Biotic Art Lab. That you said it's fairly new. It launched like just in this past year in 2020. So what led you to co-founding it? Why do you feel like it needed to be created?
So the European market for medical illustration is very different from the US in many ways. I think overall the US market has a lot more companies and big pharmaceutical companies that dominate that field. So it dictates what is created. So if you look at the students that come out of American programs, they generally trend towards 3D modeling. And if you look at Europe, it's still very 2D and illustrative. And I like 3D, but I wanted to be able to draw more than model. So I decided to stay here, and most people end up doing freelance work. So it's very solitary, and because there are fewer companies over here. And me and my two friends, Margot and Ezra, decided we're gonna end up doing freelance anyways. Why not work together? We have different strengths, and together our work is so much better than if we just sit alone in our apartments competing against each other for work. So and there's also not a lot of tiny medical illustration studios. There's only one other maybe in Europe, and then we decided that we could be the second.
Yeah, that's super smart. And you know, I definitely see like the need for collaboration in such a competitive industry. So that makes total sense. I guess more broadly, actually, I kind of wanted to ask a bit more about your graduate program too. So like, you know, you met your classmates, Margot and Ezra, and, I'm sure you learned a whole lot about the field itself, but, how else would you say your master's program, benefited you as both like an artist and someone who is interested in the field?
The program works off an atelier model. So they really believe in giving you a lot of freedom to work at your own pace and then also learn from each other. And that's not something that I was used to at all coming from the US. I'm just used to being given a stack of things to read and then homework assignments due at certain times, but that was not how it was at all here. And I think it actually mimicked what the professional environment would be, where no one's holding your hand and you have to figure out how to get from A to B on your own. So the professors that were there have a lot of experience. They were all at one point students of the program. So they were there to help give guidance, but not influence your style in any sort of way. And I remember that being one of the things that I asked week one. I said, how do I know what my style would be? And you just have to create a lot of work. And that's what they gave us the space to do, to just create a lot and then see what naturally comes out of what you can do. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a favorite class or project while you were there?
I really enjoyed working on my thesis because we had the freedom to choose whatever topic we wanted. And it's a bit different from the North American programs because I think they have a list of projects that need illustrations and the students have the opportunity to choose from them. But for us, we could create any topic that we wanted so long as we found advisors. So we created our thesis is from scratch. So I decided I rock climb when I'm not working. So I wanted to do something related to climbing. And I fabricated this idea around mountain goat anatomy and human anatomy. And there's zero people in the world doing research on that. So I was able to find advisors and foray into what it's like to find people who are interested in working with you, which has been really valuable for starting my own company.
Yeah, I really like how you've emphasized kind of the freedom within the program, because I think that's so important for the visual arts program as well, because it's all creative. So I guess more broadly, though, how would you say medical and scientific illustration differ from other types of art? And also, how is it similar? Because I imagine you still have to study how to draw anatomy, how to, you know, proportions and all those things.
It differs from traditional fine arts because it serves a very specific field, which is medicine and science. So there's already a target audience, and that's what all of the work that we create has to keep in mind from the beginning. And that's why it's different from fine art, because we have to make sure that the piece looking good is just one part of it. The piece being practical and educational and serving a function is more important. And then style gets to come on top of that afterwards. Style is almost like the last thing that you choose. But the way in which it is similar to art is that each medical illustrator has a different feel, and some people play with colors differently, some people play with line weight differently, and over time you see certain medical illustrators influencing others. So in that way, it's very much like the fine art world, where we're creatively inspired by each other, and there are trends in medical illustration that I would have never thought were even important or a thing many years ago. So like, I think all of us were very inspired by the old vintage looking scientific illustrations that are in posters that we see on Pinterest, and that kind of desaturated color was super popular. But now with Instagram, really bright, fun colors are in trend, and that affects design of fashion, and it's also affecting medical illustration. And that's just funny to see that we're not separate, even though we are a field that's attached to science.
That is so interesting. I never would have thought that, first of all, medical illustration posters would be even on Pinterest, and then also that Instagram can, well, I mean, you think of Instagram, you think of like modern fashion trends and how animation evolves, but like, it's so interesting how it can kind of lean into the medical field as well, and the different colors and stuff, that makes sense too, because sometimes I think there's a design element to it as well, where sometimes things are more understandable if they're drawn a certain way, or colored a certain way. So I don't know, the field is so interesting, because I think the average person doesn't really think about it too much. Like, they'll just kind of skim over the posters they see in textbooks or posters or doctor's offices. So like, do you almost wish that like people knew about it more as like a legitimate field of illustration?
It doesn't really matter to me, because I think when people do finally learn about it, it's this aha moment, because everyone has studied from a textbook before, from childhood to now. So medical illustration goes on regardless of whether people notice it or not. And it's kind of like good design, where if it's done well, you almost don't notice it, because it's just meant to convey knowledge or information. And if it's done poorly, you remember it. So it like flies under the radar if it does a good job. And then it kind of subconsciously sticks in your brain.
Yeah, like we don't think about like road signs or anything at all, but that was all designs at one point.
This has been The Weekly. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio.
So currently, you know, you've started Biotic Art Lab. How is that going? Has it been impacted at all by COVID, and have there been any challenges?
Definitely challenging. Originally, since our program focused on both human medicine and animal medicine, veterinary medicine, we believed that we have this training, so therefore we can target both zoos and natural history museums, as well as physicians and hospitals and research institutes. But with COVID, it's been easier to spot which communities are impacted more. So we've definitely started to trend more towards working solely with medicine, just because medicine doesn't stop, and that industry has a lot of different needs. So it's not just doctors, but it's also doctors creating apps or doing research or creating a new product that they're trying to sell at Walgreens. So you can kind of see which fields within scientific and medical illustration are more stable than others.
Are you able to share like what kind of projects you've been working on in medicine?
So that's the tricky part. There's a lot of confidentiality around certain projects because they're linked to research that has not been published. But let me think.
But that's also cool in a way that you're able to kind of get insider access to research that's going on.
Yeah, I can give you an idea of types of people who we've been working with. I just made a list of it the other day, and we're primarily working with physicians from different fields like orthopedic surgery, cardiology, dermatology, oncology. And these are physicians that are all over Europe and also in the US as well. And then what else? We're also working with wilderness medics in Oregon, creating material, educational material for them. So it comes in many shapes and forms.
So it is a challenge because COVID has kind of restricted who you can work with, but at the same time, it's created more demand specifically from the medical field.
Exactly like that. And yeah, I think this year people are starting to understand how to work within COVID as well. So I feel very lucky that the type of work that I can do from anywhere. So I can live here, I can move back home. And I mean, you hear about all these big companies like Dropbox saying that there's no more office anymore. All work can be done remotely. So I think it's important in a time like this to learn how to be flexible or like potentially pick a career or work that will kind of be not bulletproof, but allow you to not be limited if something like this happens.
Yeah, it's really interesting because actually, as I'm sure you remember, Oberlin got so much snow during the winters, and yesterday we had a bit of a snowstorm. But we did something that I'd never seen before in my years at Oberlin. They actually closed campus, so they only had like the dining halls open and some spaces on campus, but like all the academic buildings were closed. All classes were online, and my classmate wondered like if they only did that because we have Zoom now and we're able to do that. Just because we have the option of online classes, I guess Oberlin can afford to close campus now in bad weather. Yeah, so I also wanted to ask, since this is going on the Office of Communications website, what advice would you give to anyone interested in a similar career path? So if anyone were to see this and like got interested in the field, what would you advise them?
I would advise them to go onto the AMI website, AMI.org, that stands for the Association of Medical Illustrators. And and that site will give you all the information that you need for the North American programs. And then if you want information on the European programs, because there's a few, but they're not all necessarily master's programs. There's also bachelor's programs. I would go into the AIMS website, AEIMS.EU. So those two websites will help you cover Europe and North America and just kind of look and see what each program offers because they do have very distinct styles. Some of the programs in Canada have a much more rigorous science background, so they almost want straight scientists to apply, and then the other programs want more of a combination of an artistic background and a science background. So it really depends on where you find yourself falling in the spectrum.
And you mentioned in the video how like the program's great for people who are kind of caught between art and science, but what other like traits or skills would you say like people who are more suited towards this field have?
I think that you have to be very self-motivated to do this because as an artist, you can put your work down at any time, but you have to decide when to keep pushing on. And most of the time when you're interacting with clients in the medical field, they've never worked with a medical illustrator, so their standard is quite low. So you could do almost anything and they'll be so happy with the result, which is what makes this field so rewarding. But at the same time, you know, you're adding more work out there into this massive pool of images, and it's very easy to create bad work. You see a lot of people copying each other. You see a lot of people tracing over images and altering them slightly. And you can do a great, you can do a fine job and make a career out of that. But I guess it's up to you being self-motivated and having the integrity to better the medical illustration field instead of just generate content.
I think that's a super important distinction, because with this kind of illustration specifically, it relies less on individual creativity, so it is really easy to fall into those patterns. So looking forward, what would you say is next for you with Biotic Art Lab or career or anything really?
We're looking at creating more 3D projects right now. We have some stuff coming in the pipeline that are creating some educational material related to COVID. So I think that'll be cool when we can finally release it. And then just seeing what types of new projects we can take on. We have some app projects, which are pretty cool, that I would like to be able to share once they're done. Medical illustration is not just pictures, and that's the cool part about it. You can do a lot with it. So for anyone who's interested in design or art or medicine, I would definitely recommend taking a peek into this field.
And before I wrap up, was there anything that you wanted to plug or promote, like the website or social media? Because sometimes alumni will remind me by email, so.
Yeah, I would love to share the website with you. So it's biotic-artlab.com. Instagram handle is biotic.artlab. And we'll be redoing the website soon. But yeah, those are the two things.
So Tiffany, thank you so much for your time. It was so great to meet you and learn more about what you do. Because again, like I hadn't really considered medical or scientific illustration as a field beforehand, but it was so enlightening to just learn more about what it takes to really be an illustrator and all the behind the scenes work and what people might not really think about. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for reaching out. It's cool to hear from Oberlin and see what Oberlin is, who was going to Oberlin and who's representing Oberlin. So it's a nice reminder of some good times.
And now we bring you an audio journalism project on COVID-19 vaccines from the WOBC News Workgroup. The project was produced in the spring semester of 2021 by Finn Miller, class of 2024.
The following information was taken from NPR, the CDC website, the FDA website, and Biospace.com. It has been a year since the outbreak of the COVID-19 global pandemic. The COVID-19 vaccine has now emerged as another preventative measure in our pandemic health kit. Vaccine centers have begun to pop up. Senior citizens and frontline workers have been getting their jabs. This short piece aims to demystify some misconceptions about the vaccine and provide you with all the information you need to feel safe about getting vaccinated. How does a vaccine work? A vaccine is simply training our immune system to recognize and fight off a potentially larger infection. In simple terms, a vaccine works by injecting a small, non-lethal, non-reproductive dosage of germs, like bacteria or viruses, into the body to stimulate an immune response. An antigen, or a fragment of a germ, will be introduced so that our immune system begins to create the necessary antibodies, or blood proteins that counteract antigens, to fight the infection. After this initial infection, copies of the antibodies will remain in our immune system. Should we be reinfected with the bacteria or virus, our body will produce copies of the effective antibody based on its experience fighting this particular antigen. This process is the same as if we were infected with the actual germ, however, on a much reduced and controlled scale, and thus much safer. In the case of COVID, The COVID-19 mRNA vaccine gives instructions for our cells to make a harmless piece of what is called the spike protein. The spike protein is found on the surface of the virus that causes COVID-19. Our body uses mRNA to make a coronavirus protein that your immune system can recognize and respond to. Once our immune system recognizes that the protein doesn't belong there, it begins building an immune response and making antibodies. So how did these vaccines come into production? The efficacy of vaccines and the science behind them is put to the test under clinical trials. Initially, the vaccine is given to a small number of generally healthy people to assess its safety and to gain early information about how well the vaccine works to induce an immune response in people. If all goes well, phase 2 studies include more people with varying health statuses and from different demographic groups in randomized controlled studies. These studies provide additional safety information on common short-term side effects and risks, and may provide initial information regarding the effectiveness of the vaccine. In phase 3, the vaccine is generally administered to thousands of people in randomized controlled studies involving broad demographic groups. This phase provides additional information about the immune response in people who receive the vaccine compared to those who receive a control, such as a placebo. How come the vaccine was developed so quickly? Historically, a vaccine can take up to 10 years to be fully developed. During the pandemic, the first vaccines were being used in trials only 10 months after the initial outbreak. This doesn't mean that it's any less safe. Most of the vaccines produced boast 90%+ efficacy rates, which means that the vaccine has produced the desired effects in a laboratory setting. Given that the virus is so widespread, a great deal of time, energy, and money have been put toward the vaccination effort. Multiple vaccines have begun to be distributed in the United States thanks to the Emergency Use Authorization, or EUA for short, granted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, commonly known as the FDA. An EUA is a mechanism to facilitate the availability and use of medical countermeasures during public health emergencies. For an EUA to be issued for a vaccine, the FDA must determine that the known and potential benefits outweigh the known and potential risks of the vaccine. This may seem like a low bar to cross, but an EUA request for a COVID vaccine can only be submitted based on a final analysis of the phase 3 clinical trial efficacy. Part of the FDA's evaluation of an EUA request for a COVID-19 vaccine includes evaluation of the chemistry, manufacturing, and controls information for the vaccine. The FDA will make use of record reviews, site visits, and previous compliance history to assess compliance with current good manufacturing practices. What are the differences between the vaccines that are now available? Pfizer-BioNTech. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was sent to the FDA for EUA on Friday, November 20th, gaining authorization on December 11th. It is an mRNA vaccine that consists of 2 doses taken 21 days apart. It has a 95% efficacy rate and requires storage at about negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit, which requires specialized freezers. Moderna. The Moderna vaccine was authorized by the FDA on December 19th. It, too, is an mRNA vaccine that comes in 2 doses, but Moderna's injections are taken 28 days apart, a gap of a week longer than the Pfizer vaccine. It has a 94% efficacy rate and is stable for 30 days at 36 to 46 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about the temperature of a standard refrigerator. The vaccine can be further stored for up to 6 months at negative 4 degrees Fahrenheit. Johnson & Johnson. Finally, Johnson & Johnson received authorization on February 27th. It is an adenovirus-based vaccine, which means it uses a double-stranded DNA rather than a single-stranded RNA. It requires only 1 dose and has an efficacy rate of up to 72%. This single dose can be kept in simple refrigerators for up to 3 months. The scientific community has worked long and hard to provide the population with safe and effective vaccines. Until the vaccine is offered to you, keep wearing masks, washing your hands, and staying socially distanced. This way, we can take care of ourselves, each other, and the wider community.
You're listening to WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. All previously aired episodes of The Weekly are publicly available online. You can listen to them at anchor.fm/theweekly.